Energy Stew with Peter Roth, Thursdays at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to Energy Stew. This is Peter Roth, your host. This show, I'm so looking forward to doing this because my guest has written a beautiful memoir of a very difficult life and an amazing life. And to read it is such an experience. There are a lot of books. I read a lot of books, and reading this one was such a treasure. And I'm so glad. Alan Kaufman, thank you for being on the show.
Thank you for having me, Peter.
This is... It's a powerful book to help everybody get through their stuff. The stuff that you had to get through is amazing. Amazing that you did it and wrote about it with such beautiful writing. You're an amazing writer and very gifted, and it's no surprise that I'm saying that to you because people have talked about you for a long time and your writing.
Thank you.
And so interesting. You know, you sound like a man of little words, and right now on the show, but I know that we just get you started, because actually you're one of the leaders of the spoken word.
Well, that's right. I did help found the spoken word movement in the United States. And so that was a privilege. In my first 9 years of writing in sobriety, in recovery, I've been clean and sober for 21 years. I chiefly did poetry, and then in the last 10 years, there's been a shift to prose, and I've published, this is my second memoir. I published another memoir called Jew Boy about being the son of a Holocaust survivor. And I published a novel called Matches. I kind of have moved into prose, and the more I move into prose, the less I seem to have to say. You say it all on the page, you know?
Right. Okay, everybody, just go out and get the book, and that'll be it.
But I really do appreciate your comments about Drunken Angel. It is a book that covers a subject that I wasn't especially interested in putting out there publicly, and that was the fact that for 22 years of my life, I was a chronic alcoholic, and for the last 21 years of my life, I've been clean and sober. And I always considered that kind of a private matter. But Brenda Knight, the editor at Viva Editions, and Felice Newman, the publisher of Cleus Press, both approached me with a request that I write about my recovery, and I was somewhat taken aback by that request. I wasn't sure how I would go about that, but realized that in a way, something inside of me had been narrating this story for many years, and that I just had to access that. And I'd be able to tell the story.
It's a very rough story, and reading it is... The talent that you have to put it into words is amazing, because so many people understand alcoholism from a detached place. I mean, you know, maybe we have it in our family. Some people do, a lot of people don't. And a lot of people are alcoholics, and yet the people who... don't experience it, like your own daughter didn't. She had to learn by going to a meeting with you, and
exactly
right. And so a lot of people don't understand how hard it is and how impossible sometimes it is for alcoholics to move on and break it. And your book really gets into the heart of your alcoholism. In the middle of it, you bring the reader through the whole story of your drunkenness.
In yeah, way, in, I wanted.
Yeah.
Yeah, please. You know, I wanted to show what it was like, you know.
Right. Well, you do it beautifully because your ability to write is so rich that your readers are with you.
Well, that's wonderful to hear. I really wanted in the writing of the book to, even though the book is about my experience, I wanted to take me out of it and not do any kind of proselytizing or editorializing and just let the reader experience what it's like both to be an alcoholic in your drinking, in your cups, and also what it feels like to put the drink down and to, you know, get into recovery. And, I think I made an important point for myself in the book not to come across as, you know, look how perfect I am now that I got clean and sober, you know. I'm still, you know, an angel with broken wings, you know, and I'm not perfect at all.
Well,
I wanted to show that to people, that we don't become perfect as we put a drink down. We still have our incorrigible dimensions that we're working on. You know, it's progress, not perfection.
Well, even after you stopped drinking, you picked up another addiction for a while.
Exactly. I picked up sex for an addiction. And,
right.
And I portray that in the book, sometimes rather graphically. And,
yes.
But I wanted to show what it was like. And, you know, it has comic elements, too, you know.
Sure. No, this book, you know, it's helpful to everybody because you don't have to be involved with alcohol in your life to have your own addictions of any sort. And they can be minor addictions that drive you nuts.
That's right.
And
that's right. And, yeah. And they can take you to a place of despair. And they can turn one's life into a mediocre kind of, place. And I think, you know, the idea is not to, you know, don't wait until you hit some terrible bottom, you know, to finally address your addiction. But if you notice that this is interfering with your life, you know, I don't want to proselytize here, but if you notice that if it's interfering with your life, you can stop now. You can get help now. And I think the big message of Drunken Angel is, you know, we can't do this thing alone. If we really want to change our life, if we really want to get out of the nightmare, then we have to ask for help. You know, we have to put down our pride and reach out. And a hand will be there to take us, you know, to our next place.
I counsel a lot of people, and everybody has their different habits and addictions that they can't seem to break, and now I'm, you know, my idea is, well, find a meeting. and there aren't meetings for a lot of these things.
There are so many paths to help out there, and, you know, I don't promote one or another. I think that if one reaches out for help in any way to anyone that, you know, qualified or can help, that's terrific. Then the process begins. And, you know, it's never going to lead to perfection, but it certainly is going to lead to a great improvement and even possible happiness and fulfillment, you know. And I think we all have a right to that.
Well, you had some great helpers, supporters that you found at meetings, your sponsors, who had incredible insight for you. It was beautiful to see.
Yeah, I mean, every step of the way, once I got into the process of recovery, you know, I began to meet these, you know, first some of them struck me as extremely kooky, like I described that guy Carl Little Crow, you know, who had 18 years clean and sober and was, you know, African-American and walking around in Native American, you know, paraphernalia gear and beating a medicine drum, and, you know, here I am, Bronx guy, and, you know, former soldier, and, you know, in San Francisco, talked to this guy who's, you know, beating a medicine drum and talking to the trees, you know. It was like, you know, welcome to the left coast, you know.
But he had good things to tell you.
He had unbelievable things. He opened an opening for me into the realm of the spiritual that, you know, just had not been there before. And I guess I was in enough pain and desperation, you know, that I listened.
And not only listen, but it worked.
It worked. It was amazing to me, you know. And I remember, you know, somebody said to me, you know, you're going to have to, you know, if you really want to get sober, you're going to have to get spiritual, get a little bit of spirituality. I was like, I can't believe in that stuff. I'm screwed. And he goes, yeah, that's what I'm trying to tell you. You're screwed. You're gonna have to get spiritual despite yourself.
Well, it's interesting.
So I just had to open my mind a little bit.
Right, and it's fascinating what you talk about in that opening, that spiritual opening. The part that I was even more fascinated about was your meeting with a female Jewish angel. I don't know what to call her.
Oh yeah, the Shekinah. Yeah,
right.
Absolutely.
Right, and she.
I've had some amazing experiences that, you know, sometimes I recount them to myself. I was like, wow, that's, you know, I mean, I was working on putting together this progressive, kind of countercultural Jewish, radical Jewish magazine. And I was all kind of out of ideas, and I began to, you know, and I considered, you know, my higher power, God, to be Yahweh, you know, a kind of male figure. And what I did was I began to pray to the Shekinah, it's the female incarnation of God. And I had a very palpable kind of experience, a very, very vivid kind of spiritual jolt from that, and began to get inspiration one after another. It was amazing.
Yeah, you had a vision of her, too.
Sorry?
You had a vision of her also.
I had a vision, and of her, and she kind of began to guide my hand. And this magazine was called Dafka. It was published in the 90s, and, you know, it ended up on Good Morning America and being written up, you know, all over the place. And it was a very successful magazine that kind of moved countercultural Jewish progressive, kind of movements forward. It kind of moved things forward in a way, and led to other great things.
Well, you're amazing in how you've carried on the tradition in your own way, being the son of a Holocaust survivor, and then actually going over to Israel and joining the army.
Yeah, I became an Israeli citizen. I served in the IDF. I served in two conflicts. And I considered being a Jew to be, you know, implicit in it is outsiderness. And I think that we are, by choice, outsiders, outlaws, if you will. And, you know, outlawness, outsiderness, otherness, I think is part and parcel of the Jewish tradition. And so my whole take on any approach I make to Jewish subjects always proceeds from the stance of outsiderness. And so, of course, that brought me sometimes into conflict with mainstream Jewish culture. But that also sometimes brought me into opposition with mainstream literary culture. And even in the area of the Holocaust, if I may just, you know, elaborate on that a little bit, being the son of a Holocaust survivor, when I sat down to write my first memoir, Jew Boy, about being the son of a Holocaust survivor, I really approached it in a way that hadn't been approached before. I mean, I described the particular anguish and novelty and also sometimes hopefulness of being the son of a Holocaust survivor. And When the book was published, I was terrified that I was going to meet Holocaust survivors and their children who were going to pelt me with stones for the way I described the experience, because I didn't hold anything back. And what happened instead was I got praised by a lot of groups of Holocaust survivors and their children. They all said, thank you for talking about what it really feels like.
Right. Your mother didn't handle it well afterwards.
No, and, you know, I mean, you know, we like to think that, you know, everything has a kind of Schindler's List ending, you know, you know, where everything works out great, but it doesn't always work out great. And the Holocaust traumatized I believe, not just Holocaust survivors and their children, but traumatized the entire Jewish people. In fact, I think the Holocaust traumatized the entire world and to some degree, and the world is still in denial about it, you know?
Sure.
This kind of unaddressed trauma.
And you were caught in the middle of it. You were born into it, and to a mother who actually was violent with you. And
she was.
Yeah, it's in the book.
Poor woman, you know, she was trapped there in the Bronx. It was the 1950s and early 60s, and people weren't even talking about the Holocaust then. It was considered to be a shameful thing to be a Holocaust survivor, and she was married to, you know, a Bronx Jewish street guy who didn't know about the Holocaust, and she was trapped alone with her suffering and also with her sense of abandonment. The husband, you know, my father, kind of abandoned her. He wasn't there for her. He used to go away all night long and leave her alone, and she went a little mad from the experience, and she would take it out on me. Yeah.
Right.
And I still love her. You know, I still love her. You know, she's passed away and she's gone. I love her and, you know, I forgive all that.
Sure. Well, you know, what's interesting is that as horrible as your life was, and it could have killed you easily anywhere along the way, it didn't. And yet, the what's beautiful in your book is coming out of it and finding all the beauty in life and treasuring what you really truly have, and including your daughter and your talent and the people who've cared about you and have taken care of you when you were down and out. And
yeah.
And I know that we did a show together a while back about gratitude, and that you really treasure the good stuff because you've been through so much of the bad stuff. And
I wake up every morning and I'm so amazed and pleased to be alive and not waking up in the gutter and you know, not waking up in a state of anguish, waking up, you know, proudly in my home, you know, with a beautiful life that, you know, it's almost like a gift. It's a gift. I mean, if life were fair, I should be dead, you know, the way I lived. And instead, I have a rich and beautiful, fulfilling life. And I'm very grateful for that life. And I'm grateful for that life every day.
That's the point. And I when I talk to a lot of people about their anguish, so many times people say, well, why do I have to be so unhappy? Why is life so difficult for me? And you could have said, I'm sure you did say the same thing, you know, many times. And yet you don't realize that winning, being victorious in your life has so much more thrill to it, that your heart is so much stronger and greater and more purposeful than it would be otherwise.
Yes. I mean, and, you know, I think exactly. And I think that, you know, that pain, you know, I think suffering is optional. Pain is mandatory, but suffering is optional. You know?
That's
and,
true.
We're going to live. You know, we're going to be alive. We're going to feel lonely sometimes. Life sometimes is existentially lonely. And we're going to feel pain sometimes. Life can be very painful. And life can be difficult. But that doesn't mean we have to suffer. And the question becomes, you know, how to work with this pain when it occurs, how to transmute it into gold.
And that's what your sponsors were so good at helping you find.
That's right. It was, you know, one of my sponsors once said to me when I told him that I was, unhappy, he said, be grateful that you're unhappy. Be grateful that you're in pain. Say to your higher power, thank you for the pain. And I was like, what? That's a crazy thing to say. And later I was reading a book of Hasidic wisdom. In that book, it said that the Hasidim would go around saying, thank you for the pain I'm in.
Okay, but at that point you didn't realize what it meant.
No, and I was like, how did my sponsor know that? How did he know? How did he have the wisdom of a Hasid, you know, of a Hasidic rabbi? You know, I mean, there's a lot of wisdom in those rooms. There's a lot of wisdom in recovery. And I think that being grateful, even sometimes when one is in pain, saying, even in the midst of one's pain, saying, thank you for this pain, can change things.
But understanding why you're saying it, though. Understanding why you're saying it. If you think you're stupid saying it, you're just saying it because somebody told you to say it. I don't know that, you know, how far that can get you. But to appreciate the wisdom path of it, that the pain serves a purpose. Thank you for the pain because it serves a purpose of me being able to go deeper and finding more richness in my life.
We say in recovery that, you know, take the action and understanding will follow.
Okay.
I can appreciate that.
Sometimes
we don't understand. I mean, yeah, we can agree to disagree on that. But
no, I don't. I'm willing to agree with you on it. I'm glad to hear that because we can't have it all figured out ahead of time.
No, I often take an action based on a suggestion, and I don't know why the action is suggested. I don't even know what will ensue. And then I see, you know, I take the, that's the adventure and the mystery. Well, I take the action and I see.
Well, one of the actions you were asked to take was to put it out in the universe, and, you know, ask God to take care of something for you.
That's right.
And you were shocked at what happened.
I've been many times shocked in my life at how things have turned out when I turn it over to a higher power, when I put it out to the universe, or the great spirit, or God, or whatever you want to call it, and say, you know, take care of this. You know, the results are oftentimes wonderful. And I see that I just have to sometimes get out of the way and just let the universe take care of things. You know, I don't have to run around controlling and trying to change everything.
And the book is so helpful at understanding that process, because you do describe the ways that you're stuck and the miracles that happened that were unbelievable, actually. And I was so glad
well,
to read it.
There's that time when I'm in agony. I want to go see Isadora, my daughter, in Israel, and I'm broke. I have no money. And I say to my sponsor, I want to go see my daughter, and I'm broke and I have no more money. And he says, I think you're right. You got to go see your daughter. I said, but how am I going to do that? I can't. I don't have a dime, penny one to do this. He said, well, just take the actions of pretending almost that you're going to go. Go to a travel agent and ask him how much it costs, and do a little investigation into it, and take some steps with faith and see what happens. So I did. And you know what happened? I went to a travel agent. They told me how much it costs and calculated what the trip would cost. I walked out of there feeling even more hopeless.
Of course.
Like, I couldn't possibly afford that.
Thousands of dollars.
That night, I got a fax, came in to my home from the Berlin Jewish Cultural Festival, asking me if I would fly to Berlin, all expenses paid, with Allen Ginsberg, Kathy Acker, Michael Lerner from Tikkun Magazine, and a few other people. They were doing a special program on the Jews of California, Jewish cultural stuff in California. Would I come, all expenses paid, and a few thousand dollars given to me as a speaker fee? And, of course, I was wildly excited and called, you know, my sponsor back and said, you know, this is what happened. You won't believe it. It's a miracle. And he said, yeah, well, I believe it. He said, ask them if they'll attach a leg of the trip to Tel Aviv on the return flight. And I called back and said, of course we will. And so I ended up going to see my daughter with a few grand in my pocket.
That's amazing, you know. And
it's a miracle.
But we all have to really listen closely to that and appreciate how that works, because I think that's one of the great answers in life, is to put it out there and allow the universe to get going on it.
Right. I mean, it's not always good. You know, we can't always have, you know, we can't be into magical thinking and think it's always good. But there are a lot, there are times when the heart is truly aligned with, I think, you know, kind of the universe or whatever you will, and we make a request, and the universe answers.
Last week, we had a show about prayer, actually, about a book called The Prayer Chest, and it's all about putting it out there, but not being attached to what shows up.
Right.
Just, you know, right. Surrendering means surrendering, not trying to control it through prayer.
Right, right.
And right. So, yeah, and your book really had so much of the of a surprise path through it. And your abilities have been amazing, your organizational abilities. You created a lot of literary products, let's call them, or projects and stage projects when you were in Israel. And you know, you're a resourceful guy, and you just kept on plugging away using your talent, but then self-defeating, self-destructing at the same time through
That's the early
part of your life. So the talent was there, you just couldn't hold on to it.
I couldn't, and I couldn't really manifest it. You know, I was all bought into that whole literary myth of the alcoholic writer, and, you know, the Hemingways, the Kerouacs, you know, Faulkners, and all these writers I loved, you know, were all bad drunks. And somehow I fell into that, too. And, you know, it was only, you know, ironically, when I gave that up, when it almost killed me, I said, well, that's that, you know, I want to live. And so I got into recovery that, and I gave up that role of the alcoholic writer, that's when my writing career really began. And it's in sobriety in the last, you know, in the last 21 years of sobriety, and especially in the last 11 years that I've had 7 books published. And, you know, and the dream has come true, you know. And in terms of, like, my projects, I'm now, when I conceive of projects, I think formally when I conceive the projects, I used to think about them in a rather self-serving way. And now when I think conceive of projects, I have only one question is, you know, how can this be of service?
And I
think
right.
that even in the writing of books, my orientation shifted from, you know, how can I manifest my literary greatness, quote unquote, so how can this book be of service?
Well, this book, Drunken Angel, is an incredible service. It's very, very rich writing. It's such a pleasure to read, and it's so helpful because the richness of life is through it, and to see what it takes to make things work and work out is so wonderfully handled in the book. So that it gives all of us inspiration, you know.
Thank you. That warms my heart.
Well, your book warms my heart, and I'm a great fan of yours, and I'm so excited to just watch what you're doing in the world, and I'm excited for your fatherhood. The journey with your daughter is all through this book, and it was not easy, and your love for her was always there, and. And it looks like it worked.
So far, so good.
Yeah. Well, I have children. I have 2 boys in their 20s, actually, and it's always a project to be a good father and do the best we can.
And we just have to keep showing up.
That's right. That's the point. It's amazing what you've shown up through. And I want to really recommend Drunken Angel by Alan Kaufman. And Alan, you know, it's such a treat to talk with you. And I want to, you know, congratulate you for being who you are.
Thank you, Peter. It's always a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. And this is Peter Roth, your host of Energy Stew at Progressive Radio Network. And I can be reached at peter@heartriver, HEART river.org. And thank you so much for listening.